Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dan Trochuski and a member of this particular health and medicine member-led forum and a chair of tonight's program. And tonight it's my pleasure to introduce Barbara Nanderson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, co-authors for their new book, Zubiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. And we do have books outside. We'll get to that later. Now,
sorry. This is the first time I've chaired a session at this club. I have done it elsewhere, but not here. Dr. Nanderson Horowitz, just to give you a brief background, is a physician, and she is both a cardiologist and a psychiatrist. And I could say, too, she has in the past several years become a veterinarian. So she has a lot of background in the medical sciences, obviously. She and Catherine Bowers have taken, I've looked at the remarkable correspondences between the way human beings and animals live, die, and get sick and heal in their natural settings. They've used several disciplines to look at this. They have looked at evolution, anthropology, sociology, biology, cutting-edge medicine, and zoology, and understanding what animals can teach us about the human body and the human mind. For those of you who wonder what does the name Zubiquity mean, it was actually coined by our co-authors. If any of you know Latin, the ubiquity comes from the Latin root, and Z-O comes from the Greek root meaning animal. Now, to talk about Dr. Horowitz very briefly, I did mention she is a physician. She works at the Department of Medicine, Division of Cardiology at UCLA Medical Center. And she's done a number of things, as you can see. She's been very much involved in this. She's also a graduate, initially, of Harvard University. She received her MD from UCSF here in San Francisco. And then she went to L.A., where she did her training in psychiatry and cardiology. She has been interested in psychiatry and cardiologists to focus on the relationship between psychological states and heart disease, which many of you here know, of course. I'm not going to go on and on about Dr. Nanderson Horowitz because I'm sure you'd want to hear her talk about this. Now, Catherine Bowers is a co-author. She's a writer and an editor. And they finished the book, which we're talking about. She is not a formally educated scientist. She's obtained her science background informally since her dad was a professor at UC Santa Barbara. So she grew up in a household which was very scientific, had a lot of scientific people visiting, and as a result, and because her dad took her on many, many field trips, she became a scientist by default. She has been working with Dr. Nanderson Horowitz on the book, and basically what they're trying to do, I would say, is to urge readers to keep looking further left on the evolutionary timeline beyond the early hominids and primates to be able to look for shared links that we humans have with health and everything that came before it. I should also say that our editor-writer, Catherine Bowers, graduated from Stanford.
I did.
I leave it to you now.
Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here. I just want to make a minor correction on that wonderful introduction. I'm a physician. I'm a cardiologist. I take care of human patients. But I was given this really amazing privilege and opportunity that a few physicians have around the country to occasionally consult and advise in zoos. It's done in most zoos. They're what are called medical advisory boards. So the veterinarians take care of the patients completely, and they have plenty of subspecialists. But occasionally they use doctors, physicians, academics to collaborate, and there's a wonderful tradition of that. And it was through that experience that I had this insight that there's this parallel universe of medicine, of veterinary medicine, and that veterinarians were taking care of patients with the same problems that I was taking care of, and that my profession and their profession needed to be much closer together, and that was the epiphany. So I'm not a veterinarian. But having said that, I admire veterinarians very much, and actually we've been told that the book is a love letter to veterinarians, which was not the intention. So let's go ahead and start. So I take care of human patients. I'm a cardiologist at UCLA, and then one day I was given this opportunity to go from Ronald Reagan Medical Center at UCLA to the zoo, where I participated in the care under the supervision of the veterinarians. I had an opportunity to do a transesophageal echo, a cardiac ultrasound, on a lioness who had a collection of fluid around her heart. This is a macaw. This is a gorilla. And there's the vet behind me, and this is a gorilla. I did a taper, echocardiogram on a taper. This is an echocardiogram, which is a fascinating, very interesting evolutionarily animal. The condor, we have a big collection at the LA Zoo of condors, and they've done a wonderful, they've salvaged the condor from near extinction. So I was having this incredible experience of comparative medicine, which is nothing that, human physicians do or talk about on rounds. I've been a, training physician at a teaching hospital for 25 years, and we never talk about animals on rounds. But here I was going to the zoo occasionally and seeing these animals. So one day I was called to do an echocardiogram on a tamarin, and this is a picture of a tamarin. They're really adorable. They're Central and South American monkeys. They live at the top of the canopy of the rainforest.
Aren't they about this big?
They're little and cute.
Tiny.
And so they were sedating her. Her name was Spitzbuben, and I crouched down and was looking at her really closely, just like in her eyes, to connect, the way you try to connect with a human patient, because it makes them feel at ease, like you care. But the veterinarian put his hand on my shoulder and said, please stop making that eye contact. You're actually scaring her. So I did what I was told. I backed off. He said, if you stop that, you're going to give her capture myopathy. Mm-hmm. So I did as I was told. I backed off. But I thought to myself, capture myopathy, knew about myopathy, which means disease of the muscle. There are lots of them in human medicine, but capture myopathy, never heard about it. So I went home, I Googled it, and I learned that capture myopathy is a syndrome veterinarians know about and have known about for many decades, that animals who are scared spew adrenaline, which we call them catecholamines, these hormones, these stress hormones, that can damage the muscles of the body and sometimes the muscle of the heart, and it can cause heart failure sometimes. It can happen when animals are being chased. It can happen in different species of animals, in a wide range of hoofed animals called ungulates can get it, long-legged birds, shorebirds, flamingos. It's been seen in all kinds of animals, including rabbits.
And it turns out that eye gaze is a powerful trigger in a lot of animals, and it can mean a lot of different things depending on your species and who's giving you this eye gaze. It can be bonding, as this puppy. It can be seductive. But it can also be menacing. And it meant that what Barbara's gaze to the tamarin meant wasn't, you're so cute, don't be afraid, I'm here to help you. It was, you look delicious, and I'm hungry, and I'm going to eat you. And fear, that kind of fear, has, it turns out, predictable effects on hearts, whether that's a human heart or the heart of another animal. We have plenty of things as humans that scare us, and that might give you a heart effect when you see them. Sometimes we get scared physically. We can also get scared emotionally. And in rare cases, some people can actually get scared to death. And that actually takes us back to Spitzbuben.
So when I realized that there was a syndrome that was similar and that veterinarians were describing, I started putting them side by side. So animals who are very scared, who've been chased, who have a high catecholamine, a high adrenaline state, I put that side by side, this newly identified human cardiac syndrome called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. So what was that? So in about the year 2000, a bunch of cardiologists, it was a number of them in Japan actually, noticed that human patients occasionally who'd had high stress experiences, being left at the altar, losing their life savings with the roll of a dice, seeing a loved one die, intense emotions, would have severe chest pain. They'd go to an emergency room where they'd have an angiogram looking for a blocked artery, but there was no blocked artery. Their ventricle, simply the bottom of it, was failing. And so they called it Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, and it was fear, stress, anxiety, high emotion-induced acute heart failure. When I put capture myopathy, or one part of it, next to this syndrome in humans, I realized that they were connected. But it wasn't the connection that was as interesting to me as the next aha moment. Veterinarians have been writing about, treating, even finding ways to prevent capture myopathy in their patients for decades. It's in the literature, going back at least to the 1970s. And the human medical community had identified this only in the year 2000. And so I thought, oh my goodness, I'm a clinical cardiologist who has this privileged little opportunity to hang out at the zoo with some vets. And I've made this connection, and I thought, what else do vets know that the medical community doesn't know? And that took us on a journey.
So we started asking ourselves a simple question: do animals get fill in the blank? And we asked questions like, do animals get breast cancer, sudden cardiac death, Hodgkin's lymphoma, do they get melanoma, brain tumors, erectile dysfunction, leukemia, torn aortas, do animals get syphilis? And for every one of these conditions, it came back a resounding yes. We found these animal correlates everywhere we looked.
Starting with, let's say, cancer. So we learned that exotic animals, unusual animals, get the same kinds of malignancies that happen in human beings. Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, has successfully battled and written about his successful fight against Hodgkin's lymphoma. And we learned that Hodgkin's happens in a number of animals. There was a case of an orca from Iceland who unfortunately died of Hodgkin's. Neuroendocrine tumors affect animals and humans. There's even a case of a squamous cell carcinoma in the horn of a rhinoceros at the LA Zoo, a same kind of squamous cell carcinoma that can affect human beings and sometimes at the site of nail injury.
And what's interesting about that is that rhinoceros horns are made out of keratin, and that's the same material that our fingernails are made out of.
And then we looked at breast cancer, which is, unfortunately, a huge killer of women in the United States and elsewhere. And we asked, do animals get breast cancer? And yes, in fact, they do. Many animals do. Any mammal can, by definition, have breasts, can get breast cancer. It's been seen in kangaroos and llamas and even beluga whales. But what was fascinating when we began doing research is that there are certain animals that seem to be more predisposed. In zoos, big cats, for example, including jaguars, have an increased incidence of both breast and ovarian carcinoma, which led to an intriguing hypothesis by a veterinarian that a mutation that's seen in women, human women, who are at elevated risk for breast cancer, it's called the BRCA1 mutation, might exist in jaguars. And it turns out in some dog breeds, including English Springer Spaniels, the BRCA1 mutation does predispose them to breast cancer. Interestingly, we also learned that there seems to be one group of patients, animal patients, that have a reduced risk of breast cancer, and those are dairy cows and dairy goats, what they call the professional lactators, animals who basically breastfeed for a living. And that reduced incidence tracks with the human epidemiology that reveals a protective effect against breast cancer with breastfeeding. And finally, we learned that cancer was not only not uniquely human, it's species-spanning, it's not unique to our contemporary times. Of course, we do lots of things to amplify our risk of cancer, but the fossil record endorses the existence of both benign and malignant tumors in the bones of even dinosaurs.
And over the last 10 years or so, veterinarians have been noticing gorillas and some other primates dying of torn aortas. And that was also a leading cause of death for gorillas, and also is what Albert Einstein died of and Lucille Ball. And sadly, recently, John Ritter, the comedian John Ritter. A few years ago, there was a forest fire in Australia, a massive forest fire, and an iconic photo emerged from the scene, which was a firefighter kneeling in the dust, the ashes, holding a water bottle to the lips of an exhausted koala. And it became kind of a famous photo of animal-human cooperation. Everything seemed to go okay. The koala, her name was Sam. She was taken to a sanctuary, and her feet were bandaged, and she was nursed back to health. But she actually died a few months later, but it wasn't from her injuries from the fire, but of chlamydia. And again, as a non-physician, non-veterinarian, I was sort of surprised that an animal could get a sexually transmitted disease. But when you think about it, animals are not practicing safe sex. They're not using condoms. Most of them have multiple partners. And so in a way, I was sort of surprised that I was so surprised. But once we started looking into it, there are sexually transmitted diseases in insects. Dolphins can get genital herpes, and dogs, even our pet dogs, can get something called a transmissible venereal tumor. And then there's obesity.
And then we kept asking, do animals get? And, of course, we were batting 1,000. There's an animal correlate to everything. What about obesity, which is identified as a leading health threat? So it turns out there are parallel epidemics of obesity happening all around us. We have our human obesity epidemic, but our companion animals are getting fatter too. Up to 40% of our dogs and cats now meet criteria for overweight and are trending towards obesity. And in a way, that's not that surprising, right? They live under our stewardship. They eat the food we give them. If we don't exercise, they don't get exercised. And actually, there are programs that are looking, healthy pet, healthy family programs that are looking to treat both the obesity and the pet and the animal. So it turns out, believe it or not, there's even something called the Katkins diet for felines, which is a low-carbohydrate, high-protein diet. In some zoos, there's a Weight Watchers point system that they're using to help some of the animals reduce. And we even learned that liposuction is occasionally done for dogs with large lipomas that threaten to injure their spines or their hips. So companion animal obesity is a big issue. But what we were really interested in is, do wild animals ever get fat? So I, having really not spent any time thinking about this, if I had, I probably would have thought, well, in the wild, animals are out moving about. They have lots of exercise and
they're
limited
eating the foods that they evolved with.
Yeah, exactly. And that there's probably scarcity. So, you know, I hadn't thought about it. But it turns out that occasionally nature provides an excessive bounty. There may be a period of time where predators are decreased. They've been culled, perhaps, or a number of things can happen in the wild which allow for abundance and easier access. And it turns out through our interviews with veterinary nutritionists that animals, not just us, will overconsume. In fact, the expert that we spoke to about this said that he believes in pretty much every species, given the opportunity to overconsume, there's an evolutionary, hardwired trend to do that. So that was very interesting that obesity was not uniquely human. But as we pushed on, we looked for factors that might help us understand human obesity. When I see a patient who's overweight in my office, I typically talk to them as an individual. I say, you need to exercise more. You need to cut down on what you're eating. You need to exert more willpower or be more mindful. But when a wildlife biologist sees a group of animals that are gaining weight, they ask, what's going on in the environment? They view obesity as a disease of the environment. And interestingly, some people in human public health are beginning to recognize that model for us as well. And it's not just our built environment. It's also perhaps factors that we haven't considered before, changes in climate, changes in light day cycles from sky glow, even potentially some infectious issues. We don't know, but we should be open to it. And as part of our research, we encountered several examples of virally induced obesity in rats and even a parasite-induced metabolic syndrome in dragonflies. I mean, metabolic syndrome in dragonflies, who knew?
Well, I'll tell you who knew. The veterinarians know that infection can cause all kinds of things, including sometimes obesity. And so it turned out that Zubiquity is not just a story about animals and the diseases that they get. It's also a little bit the story of the relationship between veterinarians and physicians and what that history was like and how it's been sometimes chilly at times.
Well, I have a little bit of dirty laundry to air. It may or may not come as a surprise to some of you that physicians can be snobs sometimes.
Present company accepted, right?
and it, we do it, by the way, not only to people who are not physicians. Even within medicine, sometimes surgeons will look down on, you know, psychiatrists, and there's a whole thing going on. So I never, you know, again, before I had gone to the zoo, I wasn't spending a lot of time thinking about veterinary medicine, but remembering back to when I was a fourth-year medical student trying to decide what I wanted to do my residency in, I remember a kind of cocky surgical resident giving me some advice. I had contemplated briefly going into pediatrics, and he said, "Ugh, you don't want to go into pediatrics. That's like practicing veterinary medicine." And that was an attempt to disparage pediatrics, but in fact, without even realizing it, it was just a kind of a representation of, I think, some of the misunderstandings about what veterinary medicine is.
And it's actually really ironic because the more we learn, the more we realize that veterinarians in many ways have the harder job. They have to be pediatricians, adolescent medicine doctors, geriatricians. They have to be surgeons and dermatologists and GI specialists. They have to treat mammals and reptiles and birds and fish and, depending on their practice, even exotic insects. And they have to do it all with patients who can't tell them what's going on. And it turns out that they actually have a joke of their own. Some of them whispered it to us, that what do you call a veterinarian who treats only one species? A physician, yes. But it does turn out that, they can't talk to their patients unless it's Mr. Ed. Some of you will recognize that photo. But it does turn out that animal and human medicine used to have a closer relationship and, in fact, in some ways sprang from similar roots.
Yeah, Rudolf Virchow is one of the fathers of modern medicine. He's considered the father of modern pathology. But if you ask any medical student or veterinary student, they know of Virchow. A number of medical syndromes are actually named after him. And he wrote in the 19th century, "Between animal and human medicine, there is no dividing line, nor should there be. The object is different, but the experience obtained constitutes the basis of all medicine." And it turns out both human and veterinary medicine claim the same fathers. Despite our parallel paths, we have the same fathers. Sir William Osler, for example, who every medical student would tell you is the father of modern medicine, is also a father of modern veterinary medicine. And until we did this project, I was unaware that he was one of the founders of McGill's Medical School in Montreal. The fields were probably closer together 100 to 200 years ago when animals and humans occupied a closer relationship. But at the turn of the century, with the introduction of the combustion engine, transportation animals such as oxen and horses became displaced, and the role of veterinarians became less central. Consequently, veterinary and human medicine started moving farther apart. In addition to that, veterinary schools were established at the turn of the century in agrarian agricultural areas, whereas medical schools were for the most part in urban areas. And this also contributed to this bifurcation separation, which continued until recently.
And I think that this bifurcation isn't just for physicians and veterinarians and between those two fields. I think that if you were to look at the humanities and even our art and our literature, we're pretty focused as humans on how we're different from all other species. And we get very caught up in that little percent difference, and we overlook the vast amount of, now we know genetic material, but also similarities we have to other species. I have a particular, my ears perk up when I hear the phrase, "Man is the only animal who, ... fill in the blank, can do math, uses tools, speaks, uses language, is altruistic." Because even Darwin at one point said, we do not like to consider ourselves animals, but we're actually much, much closer than I think we've we've been willing to admit. And that leads into sort of the behavior and mental side of our species and personalities that is the next thing that we started looking at together.
Yeah, I mean, we approach this whole thing very skeptically. In order for this to be scientifically valid, we had to be very skeptical, and I'm skeptical by nature, and we didn't want this to be sentimental. So when we asked the question, do animals get, we applied it. If I saw it in a human patient at UCLA, I asked it, and we applied it, you know, we looked in the veterinary literature. So cancer, yes. Heart failure, yes. Medical syndromes, infectious disease, yes. What about mental illness? We assumed that was going to be a no. Or, well, we didn't know. But we asked anyway.
So we asked our question again, do animals get obsessive-compulsive disorder, separation anxiety, eating disorders, suicidal behavior, self-injury, sometimes called cutting? Do they get bullied? And do they get high? And again, we were surprised to see that we had yes answers to all of those.
The first one that we actually took on, I saw a woman in my clinic. A woman in her 30s came in. She was having palpitations, but I noticed when I was examining her, she had healed but horizontal lines on her left forearm. And I asked her about it, and she was a self-injurer, what psychiatrists call cutting, or, you know, it's pretty well known. And that seemed uniquely human. It seemed so disordered to me that I thought, aha, we found one where there's just no way. But a very quick survey of the veterinary literature revealed that animals self-injure a lot and across a wide range of species. So this is a case of something called acrylic dermatitis. So this is a dog who's been licking and licking his skin and his fur until the fur's come off and the skin is broken. And it turns out even birds, parrots, for example, will sometimes peck at their skin until they bleed. Some pluck their feathers out, which reminds me of a human syndrome called trichotillomania, which is a problem where people pull out their eyelashes and eyebrows. But even horses do something called flank biting when they're stressed.
Yeah, horses are herd animals, and sometimes in our human context, they live in stalls and barns a little bit on their own. And one thing that veterinarians know is that stress, isolation, and boredom can bring on some of these behaviors in animals. So sometimes if horses are alone, they will bite at their skin and repeatedly do it, draw blood, and injure themselves. But they've noticed that if they return the horse to their herd, to the natural grouping, those behaviors can sometimes get a lot better. They also sometimes provide the animal with a companion, sometimes of another species. A chicken or a goat will sometimes work, and that will also help the horse reduce those self-injuring behaviors.
What was interesting to me, particularly as a psychiatrist, is if I saw a patient with a self-injury, my approach would have been to talk about her childhood, to talk about the acute stressors in her life, to be psychodynamic. And I might treat with medicine, I might treat with psychotherapy, but I would have talk therapy as my primary approach. Knowing, though, that veterinarians can predict, in a certain sense, which animals are at risk for self-injury, looking at three factors: stress, isolation, and boredom. And they take measures to counter those three factors. I thought that's information that needs to be put in the hands of psychotherapists, of parents, of psychiatrists, of physicians, that kind of translational information. While we're looking at the horse, we also asked sheepishly at first, do animals get sexual dysfunction? And it turns out they do. They can. We spent time in a stallion breeding farm, and we watched as the expert veterinarians bred their stallions. And we learned that how a stallion is raised can determine his sexual health and function later in life. They know, for example, that too much sexual activity too early can be detrimental to his function later. And they take care to not put a young stallion with what they call a mean mare early, lest that psychological trauma affect his performance later. We also learned that lemurs, for example, who go into estrus once a year, for the most part, with some exceptions, during that period, it's a real wild free-for-all. The males want to be the lucky guy, and it can be dangerous for one male who's copulating with a female because one of his conspecifics can come and try to, you know, pull him off. So they're hypervigilant. And sometimes they have, essentially, it's coitus interruptus, and what the veterinarians call them failed copulations. And it just provided, and it's fear, stress, they're hypervigilant, and that activated state is associated with these failed copulations.
We also looked at addiction, substance use, abuse, and seeking in animals. In Tasmania, they grow a lot of medical opium. It's one of the leading providers of medical opium to the world. And you can imagine that securing that many acres of fields could be very hard, and sometimes they get animals that break into the fields, eat the poppy sap and seeds, and get high, and wallabies are an animal that do that. There's also, some of you may know this, that cedar waxwing birds are very prone to eating berries. They are frugivores, and sometimes those berries are fermented, and the animals will eat them, get intoxicated, and then sometimes fly while intoxicated, flying under the influence. And it's a funny thought, but they sometimes fly into glass walls, depending on what neighborhood they're in, and they die by the flockful from the same traumatic injuries that human physicians see in drunk driving accidents. Broken bones, internal bleeding. These were some that were in an accident in Los Angeles County.
We also asked the question, do animals get eating disorders? And I assumed, again, that would be uniquely human. But we quickly learned that animals exhibit a number of eating behaviors that if a human being was doing them, we would definitely call them disordered. For example, binge eating is a common thing that you see in both wild animals who have access to abundant food, and with good reason. Why wouldn't an animal who has scarcity much of the time gorge when they encountered abundance? Some wild animals have been seen, for example, tamarind, to overconsume berries to the point that they're excreting the fruit whole. And there we had fish examples where there's just this ravenous overconsumption and excretion of flesh, essentially. They can't even absorb it. But we also wondered about, we asked, do animals get anorexia nervosa, which, again, I assumed connected to body image.
We were trying to get a no. We were trying, like, how more human could you get than a condition seemingly connected to body image?
And just, I should point out as a caveat, we're not saying that these are identical conditions, right? But we're saying that there are parallels, there are commonalities, that we shouldn't, just because there's a difference doesn't mean that we should reject the information as not connected. That's not responsible scientifically. And we learned that there are pigs that occasionally, under stressful circumstances, when they're transitioning from, when they're weaning to being more autonomous, and they have to find their place in the herd, the hierarchy, they can actually decrease eating in response to stress. In some cases, stop eating altogether. Their hair gets thin the way a human anorexic patient's hair can get thin. They don't go into estrus the way a human anorexic patient may stop having her periods. And in some cases, they can actually starve themselves to death. This association was noticed by a psychiatrist and it was not a veterinarian. It was an agricultural expert who worked on a farm. So we thought that was fascinating. And we also learned that zoo veterinarians and veterinarians who work in marine settings have seen a self-induced vomiting syndrome in some of their animals that seems to be done in response to stress, perhaps. There's a human eating disorder called rumination disorder, where people bring up their vomit and they chew and they swallow. So this resembles that, and it also has some connections potentially to human bulimia nervosa as well.
On the eating disorders, on this along the lines of failed copulations, that there are these phrases that I found especially interesting from the wildlife biology literature and the veterinary literature that I just thought could be so revealing if they were applied to the human side. And when we were researching the eating disorders, we've discovered that some animals do something called defensive regurgitation. And the idea of your digestive system being available to protect yourself when you're scared, and that you would be able to regurgitate defensively, I just thought was an interesting piece of information for psychiatrists treating people who are bulimics.
Finally, the ultimate psychiatric syndrome, I suppose, which we assumed to be uniquely human, would be suicide. Suicide seems in humans to require knowledge of death, a certain level of awareness, and we assumed there would be no animal model of suicide. But in fact, entomologists have been describing parasite-induced suicide in insects for a very long time, and it works essentially that the parasite infects the cricket or the grasshopper. We're going to show you a video in just a second of how that goes. The parasite injects a chemical into the brain of the insect, which in turn induces the insect to engage in behavior which causes him to lose his life, in this case, jumping into water. Why is this happening? Because once the cricket is in the water and dying, it's committed suicide, it allows the parasite to come out of the body and complete its life cycle. So it's a form of insect suicide. This is the cricket.
The infected cricket.
It's jumping in the water. And you see the worm, the hairworm is coming out, actually. It's sort of trailing him. And it swims away, and it can complete its life cycle that way. So it's, in a sense, a brilliant adaptation from the parasite's perspective. And it is an example of suicide in the animal world. So we found that there were all of these parallels. Very surprising. And we think it has a lot of meaning for physicians. We've also spent the last several years getting very interested in how we can bring evolutionary biology into the human medical clinic, because most of the questions, all of the questions actually, that we have in human medicine connect to our own evolution. That goes from our physical bodies to even our emotional states. Everything has emerged through natural selection. So we have started a conference at UCLA during February, which was Darwin's birth month. We hosted Evolutionary Medicine Month. We did this alongside the Department of Evolutionary Biology at UCLA with the chairman. And we invited prominent evolutionary biologists to come. And we embedded them in rounds with our medical students and our interns and our residents so that we could have this exchange about evolutionary biology. So Zubiquity, the book, the idea, is an idea that is going to bring together human medicine with veterinary medicine, wildlife biology, and ecology and evolutionary biology, hopefully to expand our perspective, to help patients understand their diseases in a broader perspective, and I hope as a physician to have my colleagues reach across the species divide, meet, in some cases, their clinical peers and collaborate, because disease and health are species spanning.
And completely interconnected.
So we are ready for questions.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Catherine Bowers and to Barbara Natherson Horowitz. Our thanks to, we also thank our audience.
No. Just remind the audience who we're.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Sorry. It's time for questions now.
Okay.
Sorry.
I just want to ask if there are any diseases that humans get but animals don't get, you know, diseases that are unique to humans and what they might be.
Yeah, well, of course, every species is unique, and there's going to be a disease that's unique to every species, if not just a virus that can affect one species and not another. For example, humans, the leading cause of heart attacks in humans is actually blockages of the arteries of the heart, the outer arteries. We call them the epicardial coronary arteries. For the most part, animals don't get epicardial coronary artery disease, but they can have heart failure the way we have heart failure, and they can have rhythm disturbances the way we have rhythm disturbances. So yes, there are going to be, for every species, I'm sure, some unique problems. The point is that the overlap is much greater than the difference.
Could I also just add that, did you say the thing about sharks? That sometimes you hear sharks don't get cancer, for example, and that's not true. Sharks do get cancer.
I was wondering, now that you know all of this about animals, that they feel fear and isolation and stress and self-harm, how do you feel now about animals in captivity in zoos or animals in factory farms that we eat? I mean, what is your position knowing what you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And the thing is that Zubiquity, our project, we're not the first people to notice and kind of name the fact that there are all these, that there are, you know, that there's this whole emotional context in which to think about animals. So it's hard to say that we've kind of arrived at a position through this. We are definitely interested in having these conversations happen with between people, relevant parties, and it's complicated, and it's not like binary. Like, there isn't a pro or a con. We have many inconsistent ways in which we think about animals. We don't, you know, even people who are strictly vegan may wear shoes that are leather. I mean, these questions are complex. What we want Zubiquity to offer is a simple, expanded perspective to say, you know, up until now, the human medical community has been ignoring the fact, not maliciously, just more out of ignorance, that in their natural setting, animals spontaneously get sick. They're born with birth defects. They sometimes get bacterial infections. They get heart failure. They have long bone fractures, right? That these things are happening, and we've been ignoring that and ignoring the doctors who take care of them and know about them, and that there's a knowledge, new knowledge that can be created by creating a bridge and having these conversations.
Actually, my comment dovetailed right on that, and that is that I've
spent a fair amount of time around animals of all sorts, and my take on it is there's a whole lot of veterinary medicine that has very frugal solutions to lots of things because it serves them. I mean, you don't, with production animals, spend a lot of money to, you know, to fix a problem. If you have an impotent bull, you get another bull. Or, you know, you do other things that make the situation work. I think in one case I remember hearing something about turkeys, that they were simply missing nickel out of their diet. And once the nickel was provided, you know. So I'm kind of curious where those overlaps are that could benefit us.
Yeah, I've definitely become a better doctor and I think a better teacher by spending time with veterinarians. They're... I want to make a generalization because, you know, all generalizations are wrong. But overall, they have fewer resources, I think, than we have. I work in a cathedral of technology at UCLA. I mean, you name it, we have it. And in a way that that doesn't necessarily make me a better doctor. Watching veterinarians, they can be very adept at auscultation, which is the art of using the stethoscope to hear heart murmurs and make diagnoses. Observation. The lion that you saw, she had this collection of fluid around her heart. It's called cardiac tamponade. It's a very dangerous condition. We take care of it with high technology and quickly in the human setting. They made the diagnosis, the vets that I worked with at the zoo, through inspection. They watched her over the course of a couple of days get lethargic. Her respiratory rate, her body posture, there's actually a characteristic body posture that patients who have cardiac tamponade, you know, did they know that that was a diagnosis? No. But later when I thought, and by the way, she had 750 cc's of fluid encroaching on her ventricle. She almost died. They made that diagnosis through inspection and observation, and then we brought in technology. I thought medical students, physicians, even, you know, I'm now 25 years out, we've lost that. So there's that whole side of it, too. By the way, veterinarians use high technology as well. It's just that in that instance, I was impressed by that.
I'm really enjoying your very interesting talk. And it's getting clearer and clearer to me that there are so many different animal species that have much more sentience, and it amazes me how little we know about that, you know, that so many are sentient and have emotions and all that. Has your research helped? Have things changed in how human patients are now treated by the study of the connection with animals? And once again, I didn't get the definition of zubiquity. Is that ubiquitous and animal?
I'll start with the definition and how the word came about, and then maybe Barbara can address the other question. We'd been working together for a few months and kept seeing all of these correspondences, and we were looking for a name for it, that something that would cover this the feeling of seeing ourselves in animals and animals in ourselves, and again, not just through physical diseases, but also behaviors and involving our evolution and wildlife biology also. And we didn't find the exact right word in the literature that existed, so we decided to create our own word by combining the Greek word for animal, zoo, and the Latin word for everywhere. So we ended up with zubiquity. Yeah, and we like to say zubiquitous sometimes too.
You know, I've done a couple of things too. I think human patients can benefit from the knowledge that animals share the same diseases. First of all, unfortunately, when patients get a diagnosis, either a psychiatric diagnosis, sometimes a cancer diagnosis, shame, blame, stigma enter the room, and those are negative, and they don't help with healing. Knowing that the problems are not uniquely human, for some patients, I think, can be destigmatizing and maybe remove the burden of blame and shame. But more than that, I've started to teach a comparative medicine course with medical students, where I teach them EKG, physical diagnosis, all the stuff I typically taught, but I do it comparatively with different animals in conjunction with veterinarians. And, you know, when you start out, most medical students, you say, how many heart chambers does a, you know, bird have? How many does a reptile have? Maybe they knew it in college, maybe in high school, but they've forgotten it. But once you start thinking about an EKG on an animal or an echocardiogram on an animal who has a different number of ventricles, you think differently about human patients. There's a cardiac condition. Occasionally a baby is born with only one ventricle. It's very serious. There's a whole series of high technology that we use. One of the things we try to do is to put an advanced pacemaker in the ventricle and time how we pace the ventricle. But it's a big question mark. What's the optimal way to pace a baby with a single ventricle's heart? Do you do 5 milliseconds between the right and the left? So one day I'm at the zoo, and they're doing an echocardiogram on a snake, on a reptile. And I'm thinking, oh, this is interesting, because a reptile, has only one ventricle, right? So the ventricle, but still there's the pulmonary artery, which should take blood to the lungs, and the aorta, which should take blood to the rest of the body. You want to have more oxygen in the aorta than the pulmonary artery. So I'm thinking, how does a snake do that? It's got one ventricle. So we put the echocardiogram on. There was a veterinary cardiologist there. He says, look what happens. The ventricle doesn't squeeze all at once. It's a little, the timing on the one side is a little different than the timing on the other. So there's a dyssynchrony, is what we call it, between the contraction on the right and the left. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking, this is, some model of this is how we could pace a human ventricle. What reptiles emerged about 500 million years ago. They've had a long time to perfect that. Just taking a picture of that echocardiogram and handing it to a human cardiologist who knows how to do mathematical modeling could result in a way to pace a single ventricle. But if you're not thinking about anything other than human beings, you never have those thoughts.
I really love this conversation. It reminds me of the biomimicry movement, the extension of environmental science. And but on another note, I work in hospice work, and I'm curious if you found any examples of that in the animal kingdom.
You mean animals with each other or veterinarians? I don't know that we saw any with animals, but we did find that many veterinarians practice some of the most humane medicine that we've seen, especially if they're working with geriatric animals. They have to encounter end-of-life issues and aging issues that are not dissimilar from what human physicians have to encounter.
There's more of a quality of life emphasis, I think. I mean, probably because euthanasia is an option in veterinary medicine. But I have thought, watching them talk about quality of life, that when I deal with residents and we deal with in the ICU with end of life questions, there's a lot that we could learn from hospice, and there is veterinary hospice.
Didn't look at that specifically, but it's really an interesting place to look.
Yeah, as a retired MD who worked in a veterinary hospital in high school, whose sort of intellectual hobby is evolution, I find this fascinating. The question I have is there a difference in the, quote, histopathology of animal diseases such as breast cancer or melanoma, et cetera, and has anybody looked into the various markers such as CA125 or BCRA genes abnormality in breast cancer?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a pathologist, but in our cancer chapter, we were very curious about tumor markers, and we particularly got into BRCA1, BRCA2, and the slide that I showed with this English Springer Spaniel, and it's in our references, there's a wonderful paper that kind of goes through tumor markers in a couple of dogs, and Springer Spaniels were the one who had the BRCA1 mutation-associated breast cancer. This Dr. Linda Munson, who is a wonderful veterinary pathologist, unfortunately she's deceased now, she wrote a beautiful paper about comparative breast cancer and identified the potential for BRCA1 mutation in jaguars as well. All of that work is currently being done. Yes.
Oh. Sorry, I think the mic's over here.
Sorry.
So we've seen the use of animals in experimentation and scientific research. So it seems like we've had the model of using animals to model the human body for research and diagnoses. I'd like you to sort of contrast what you've discovered and researched to that insight. And then also, it seems like, though, that the psychological field it's been challenged to be less than scientific. It's a hard science to subject to the scientific method. But it seems like you're suggesting an entire different axis of information that could actually make that field a lot more rigorous in terms of approaching it from the scientific method.
So the DSM. You relies largely on the DSM, the Bible for psychiatrists about how you make diagnoses, relies, yes, on behavior, but still very often on words. The entry point into making a psychiatric diagnosis involves a patient talking about how he feels, what's happened to him. And one of the ideas we have about understanding human mental illness through a veterinary perspective is that veterinarians look at behavior. And if we accept that mental illness does not reside in the prefrontal cortex, that there's an older, more expansive, evolutionarily older place that it resides, that opens up the possibility of looking more at behavior and less at words. Words can clarify, words can obscure. And I think when things are objective, there is a tendency for them to be seen as more biological and more standardized. And it's a challenge in mental health. It's not just this approach, but many others are making the diagnosis of mental illnesses more objective, more biological. And there's lots of downstream implications of that.
Can you speak a little on the aging of animals? If the average life of a man is 80 years old and a dog is 15 and they share the same diseases, are proportional spread, or is it comparative in any way so that we know in that area? Thank you.
Well, the we talk about something called the Canine Lifetime Health Project, which is a study. It's a prospective study looking at 3,000 healthy golden retrievers. They're going to be looking for risks of cancer. So cancer is a big problem for dogs. And large breed dogs, some small breed dogs, it's a concern. One of the reasons that these studies, these comparative studies in humans and animals who get cancer, can help human beings is that dogs have a shorter lifespan than human beings do. So the natural history of the disease, how it plays out, will happen in a shorter time frame. And that is, we're talking about naturally occurring cancers in dogs who are living in our homes.
Right. This is pet dogs. These are not lab animals.
But studying them offers an opportunity to understand the same processes in a kind of condensed form in human beings.
And that particular study is sometimes called Framingham for Dogs.
In just talking with veterinarians, have you met and talked with veterinarians who have a different view of human social behavior because they compare their insights into mammalian behavior or reptilian behavior and look at ours in a sort of standardized animal way, social behavior?
I've never asked that question.
Yeah, I like that question a lot. And we don't take that on necessarily in the book, although that's the kind of conversation that can come at the bar or at the, you know, various other places after the tape recorder goes off. It's an interesting question. We have talked to some veterinarians who have mentioned possibly applying certain behavioral techniques to their family members. Put it that way.
You can actually say what it is. So
go for it.
There's something called clicker training. That, and we actually learned it's not just, there are actually videos on clicker training, like your you know, 8-year-old gymnast and your baby even.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yes.
What I wanted to say is, as a physician as well, who went to medical school 25 plus years ago, none of this was taught to us. I remember the most unusual lecture was when someone from the dental school came and spoke to us. And it's just amazing that this whole sort of wealth of knowledge has been completely overlooked by the human physicians. What's your wish for this? In the future, what would you like to see come out of this for medicine, animal and human medicine?
I truly believe that when you bring two groups together that are looking at the same problems from different perspectives, you create new knowledge. At the very minimum, we think Zubiquity, this approach, is hypothesis generating. And with a good hypothesis, you can have good investigation. Furthermore, as we recognize as physicians and as patients that our health is very connected to the health of human beings, of animals, that expands the kind of the type and kind of research that we can do. It legitimizes looking across the species line to understand ourselves, and it really reinforces the environmental piece because we are in the same environment. The epigenetic, those the environmental factors that affect our genes are shared by the animals we live with in our homes, that are in our oceans, that we're swimming in, the water we're drinking. And actually, my dream, I guess, if it's a dream, is that other physicians read the book, think about it, and people who are smarter than I am, oncologists, rheumatologists, and they have the same conversation with veterinarians, evolutionary biologists, and have their own Takotsubo moment.
What is your opinion of traditional use of lab rats and monkeys and chimpanzees in studying disease, and will your work have any influence on the course of such studies?
Yeah, we really, I mean, Zubiquity really is not about lab animal testing, and we don't really have a position about it. We're really trying to open up the kind of the conversation about all of these factors. More information is important. The piece of this that is we want to emphasize that connects to testing is that Zubiquity is looking beyond the traditional kind of quagmire, you know, back forth about it, to open up an entirely new way that we can understand ourselves without testing animals through recognizing naturally, spontaneously occurring disease in animals. Until this project started, I'll be honest with you, I never thought about wild animal disease. I thought in the wild, animals die from predation, right? Or maybe starvation. If I thought about it, right? It just, yeah, the wild animals get eaten by other animals. That's it, end of story. Maybe I shouldn't admit that, but that's kind of as far as it went. Thinking now, I think, my gosh, as I said, babies are born with, there are difficult labors where where mother and baby die in nature, of course. And babies are born with abnormal birth defects, and they have infections, and they have cancer, and they have trauma, all of these things. These are the same diseases we have. We have ignored this. And we're talking about, if you only look at mammals, extant mammals living today on Earth, conservatively probably hundreds of billions of mammals around the Earth, in the oceans, in the sky, with four-chambered beating hearts, we ignore completely. So it's a real opportunity.
And the doctors who have a wealth of knowledge about their health.
I'd like to close the meeting at this point. I have a couple of... Not yet? Oh, we do? Okay.
In your clip earlier, when you showed the cricket committing suicide or parasite-induced suicide, in my own kind of a jaded, warped way of thinking, that's actually homicide, not suicide. So my question is, have you actually observed any animal model whereby, you know, depression or after the equivalence of bad day at the stock market, that an animal voluntarily jumped off the cliff or the Golden Gate or something like that?
Well, we have not seen that, although we've talked to veterinarians who have encountered that. But there's a literature, naturalists have observed what human psychiatrists call inanition, sort of a lack of interest in, when something that they lose a family member, let's say, or they get separated from the group. They stop eating, they stop taking interest in activities, and they may actually die from this sort of withdrawn, sad, I mean, I'm going to use the word sad with quotes. That is as far as we can take it. We did read naturalist descriptions of this behavior in animals from gorillas to sea lions to geese. Actually, Conrad Lorenz talked about that kind of behavior in some of the geese. So, but jumping from a building, we have not seen. But
yeah, I have a comment and a question. What I see going on in society lately is a lot more Western medicine moving a little bit more towards the Eastern philosophy of preventative, mm-hmm. like if you listen to the Kaiser commercials and things like that now. And that seems like a more holistic approach. And I wonder, do you see, it seems like you touched on that a little bit in veterinary maybe. I mean, do you see that that either veterinary and also human medicine will benefit from this and go more preventative in their approach rather than the waiting for things to happen and then treatment?
I don't know about prevention, but I do think veterinarians and wildlife biologists think less about an individual and they think more about a group and a population and the effects of the environment on all kinds of disease. And that approach, I think, desperately is needed on the human side.
We're going to close the meeting now. Firstly, I'd like to make two comments. I'd like to mention the fact that Catherine Bowers teaches a course in medical narrative at UCLA, and that's not surprising considering the fact that she's been so intimately related or associated with medicine and is also a writer-editor. As most of you know here, if you're a scientist, you write some rather dry, boring papers to the lay audience, and if you're not a scientist, you may write some rather fatuous fiction. Catherine Bowers tries to find a midpoint at which lay audience can understand medicine.
I have to just jump in and say that this is a true collaboration between the two of us.
Yes,
and,
but I understand that.
I haven't heard a dry word come out of Barbara's mouth.
And I also like to to correct the fact that I have referred to Dr. Natherson Horowitz as a veterinarian. No, what I meant to say is that not only is she a physician, but she acquired veterinary medicine through her interest these past 7 years in comparative medicine. Now, I'd like to close the meeting. So our thanks go out to these two co-authors, Catherine Bowers and Dr. Natherson Horowitz, and for their comments here today. And we'd also like to thank our audience as well and those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th birthday of this enlightened discussion is adjourned.
The book is for sale outside.
For those of you who read the New York Times 2 Sundays ago, they had a rather long article in the New York Times.
Was that right?
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautifully illustrated, we thought.
Yes, really.
Oh, thank you so much. That's great.